How are you doing, Charlottesville? Welcome to episode 80 of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. This is Janae Libby. I want to thank my sponsors, Teej.fm, that is T-E-E-J.fm. It's a podcast community created by WTJU, who is celebrating their 60th year on the air. Check out Teej.fm for more. Also, my lovely sponsors over at Patreon. Patreon is a website that helps creators and artists stay solvent so they can continue to do the things that they do best, which is create. Check out patreon.com/audaciouspod. Welcome to Audacious. Let's get the show on the road. Here we go. Hello, hello, and welcome to Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons, where food is just the starting point for many, many deeper conversations on life, on love, on the meaning of life, and on community, which is definitely the first and foremost topic on everyone's mind these days. Thank you so much for being my guest. I am Janae Libby. I am your podcast host. I am also a food writer. Writer in general. I write about food mostly, though. You can check me out at iTunes. The website is audacious.co. I'm at your favorite podcast app, whether you're on an iPhone or an Android. The iPhone, the podcast app is purple. It's right there on your phone the day you buy it. If you have an Android, you need to search out that stuff in the App Store. What is it, Google? I don't even know how you get apps on an Android. I'm an iPhone girl. But you can download your favorite app and then search Edacious, E-D-A-C-I-O-U-S. I'm the only one so far. Trademark is in the works. It has been filed. Just waiting to hear back from them. And today's interview is with Ian Glomsky of Vitae Spirits. September is Virginia Spirits Month. I just talked to Ian Thomas at Virginia Distillery Company, and today we have another Ian Glomsky of Vitae Spirits. Vitae Spirits does lovely artisanal rum and gin, orange liqueur. They're releasing an anisette soon. But yeah, we got a lot of stuff on our plate, right, since August 12th. My purpose with Audacious is connection. I want to talk with people rather than about them. And these days, I'm talking with a lot of people about what happened here on August 12th and how it affected our community. So we definitely start this conversation with that topic. I always present a little bit of food news, what's on my mind here before we get to the interview, and today is no exception. I just read today that Harrison Keevil and Wilson Ritchie are taking over Commonwealth Sky Bar and reformatting the menu to be more Virginia-focused and based to highlight our Commonwealth. So that's exciting news. I just watched a stand-up comedy special. I'm a comedy nerd from way back. Tiffany Haddish on Showtime. Girl, oh my God, she is hilarious. Check her out, Tiffany Haddish. She's in the new movie Girls Trip. I saw her on High Court on Comedy Central. She was the best part of that show. Sorry, Doug Benson, but she was funnier than you. Check out her stand-up special on Showtime. And food recommendation, Jake Bushing's wine. I just drank his Viognier. I made it with a lovely seafood risotto. It was fantastic. It paired so well. I used it in the risotto. I drank it with the risotto. And it was so good that I went to his website and bought all the wines. He's got four available. I bought them all. I cannot wait to try the other three. Well, it was last year's Viognier, so I bought this year's and I bought all the other three. We'll be talking with Jake in a few weeks, so look for that. And excellent wine. Cannot recommend it enough. Check out his website. I'll have it in the show notes and at the Wine Guild. It's over there. So go talk to George over at the Wine Guild and he can set you up with some wine. Personally, as far as Audacious goes, I am launching a few new things come fall. The first being an every other week blog post that I'm calling Audacity. Audacity is another vintage word. It is the state of being audacious. So if you are hungry, you are in a state of audacity. And what I want to do is feature other food writers in town. My first post will be a blog from Tim Gerhardt of Gerhardt's Chocolates. He just went to Ecuador and learned about how to make chocolate. I thought the post was thoughtful and fabulous, and so I will be featuring it next week. Are you a local food writer, a regional food writer? Would you like your work featured on Audacious? Contact at audacious.co. Send me an email. Tweet me at audaciouspod, and we will talk. My next newsletter next week will be focused on the events of August 12th. I have been collecting a lot of links, positive, negative, and otherwise, ones that I found interesting or thoughtful or worthy. And it will be a special one-off newsletter focusing on Charlottesville and what happened and its causes and its effects. And yes, community is on my mind so much this day and so much these days as it is all of us. I had a thought last night late, as I tend to do when I cannot sleep, and the thought was about the notion of outsiders and how it's become a real issue here in Charlottesville. And there are many kinds of outsiders. Here on the podcast, I have interviewed folks who have moved here from outside the area. They've moved from Brooklyn, they've moved from California, they've moved from all over the country because they find Charlottesville to be a lovely place to live and work. I don't know that I would call them outsiders. Maybe they're just folks who want to move here. But often, we who live here, I mean, hell, I'm an outsider myself. I moved here in 08, even though my family's from the Shenandoah Valley. For the first few years, I did feel like an outsider. And what is the notion of that? And are folks outsiders when they move here? And how long does it take for them to become local? I think about that a lot. Is it an issue? Is it not an issue? It's one I tackle every other week here on Audacious when I talk to people who weren't born here. It's a very transient city, guys. We've got a college or university here. Folks, UVA, you know, different professors come and go. It's a thing. So it's something that I tackle. Lately, we've had different outsiders. We've had people coming to protest and speak their piece, haters, people full of vitriol. None of those fuckers were from here. They weren't. We know that. And lately, we've had tour of pain outsiders, different kinds of tourists. I was outside the Juice Laundry last week. Actually, I'm sorry, it was earlier this week. And I heard two people ask someone, hey, where's Charlottesville? I want to see where that stuff happened. This was on Preston Avenue. My eyes were strained from the rolling. I almost said something. I didn't. I was like, I don't want to go there. So I just walked away. I will rant about it on my podcast on Thursday. So here I am doing that. I saw a Facebook post where there were some guys taking photos outside of First Baptist Church. Are they tourists or is it something more insidious? We know now from the events at 4th Street that it may have been orchestrated. It probably was, and that is sick. It's awful. When you see people taking photos now, is it because they are tourists or is it because they're planning something? Is it going to make us paranoid? Do we report it? Is this becoming a 1984 situation? Good God, I hope not. But we're scared. We're hurting. We're trying to heal. We're worried about the community members who live here. How do we protect our own without becoming paranoid and thereby paralyzing ourselves and our community? And you guys, with the notion of outsiders, we live in a bubble. We really do. We tend to kind of, you know, before August 12th, we tried to ignore all the hate and stuff going on outside, but it sneaks in. It's a part of us. We are of the world, guys. We're not perfect. There's hatred here. There's racial discrimination here. We know that. On every level, it exists. We are of the world, And we have to accept that. We are one town in this world. We cannot seal off our borders and protect ourselves. We have to accept and know that we are a part of this world. We cannot prevent change. We cannot prevent development. It's going to happen. Come on, it's going to happen. But you can change how you react to it. You can change how you react to it. Stay conscious. Have a voice. Use that voice. Stay woke, as they say. I don't think a public relations firm is the answer. I think we need to step up and take real long-term action to help our community and become the world-class city that we are capable of being. We are nowhere near that yet. Because a world-class city, guys, is more than just cute shops and bucolic views and a nice lawn and a gorgeous university. It's every member of our community being able to live well and happy and know that when they wake up in the morning, they will be safe. That is a world-class city, and I know we are capable of doing it. And I know that because of the folks that I talk to every other week here at Audacious. Stepping off my soapbox for the week. That's my say. I don't have any answers. I just know I'm going to keep talking about it. And I welcome your opinions. I welcome your suggestions. As always, tweet at Audacious Pod, contact at audacious.co. And let's speak with one of those lovely community members right now, shall we? Ian Glomsky is the owner and proprietor of Vitae Spirits, and he's not just a brand ambassador. He makes it. He makes the rum. He makes the gin. He makes the liqueurs. This was a great talk, and I can't wait for you to hear it. So let me shut up. Let's get to it, shall we? See you on the flip side. So much.
Yeah, no problem.
For talking with me today. Mm-hmm. And I have to drive into town whenever I do one of these things, and I always have trouble thinking up the first question. Mm-hmm. I don't have any trouble today because it's a question I've been asking everyone. How are you doing?
Oh, really well. No, it's really well.
You do, like, with everything that's happened here in Charlottesville?
We had some excitement.
Yeah. To say the least.
Well, even just next door, I'm not sure if you saw this, but this was on CNN, is that Ace Biscuit had an incident on Sunday, kind of the day after the mess. And he called in backup from over here, so you can see what's sitting over there still from that day. So
holy crap.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you read about it, but basically...
I heard what happened.
Yeah, he served some customers that he had suspicions about, but then when they finished their meal, they got up and started doing Sieg Heils in the middle of his restaurant.
Oh, for God's sake.
And it became like a big, like obviously a yelling match, and he was telling them to get out and everything, but they said, this isn't over, we're coming back with all of our buddies. And that's when Brian came next door. We weren't actually open yet, but then he got all of us and got up. We basically had our firearms ready when
that's
birthday
crazy.
Came back. So, yeah.
Here.
Yeah. And it was, we didn't have that much. That's the only kind of activity we had here. We had tons of people going up and down the streets on both sides.
Yeah.
And I stayed open because it was a little bit of a form of protest. Like, I didn't want to fold.
Sure.
But it really hurt our business, though, too. Like, I mean, it was probably our worst weekend since we've been open since last October or something like that. So
people just staying away.
Yeah. I mean, like, no one was going out having fun that day.
No.
Or that weekend, I would actually say.
And in the summer when students are away, that's awful.
Yeah.
Because you need that business.
Yeah. And that's, like I said, we haven't been through the whole year cycle yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I was told by like neighbors and the barbecue place next door and everything like that, that the summer is the quietest time anyways.
Sure.
And they often kind of either send everybody away on vacations or do minor layoffs in the summer.
Yeah.
And so July was really slow. So we're hoping August to kind of kick up a notch, and that event on August 12th kept that from happening.
I read about Brian's thing. I want to talk to him about it because I've met him before.
Uh-huh.
Because I've met you.
Uh-huh.
Because I used to record at Sarah's shop.
Right.
And a flash laser upstairs.
Yeah. And
we
used to know this, but Sarah's employee, Carrie,
yeah,
works
I know
for
her.
Us now, too.
Oh, she does?
Yeah, she works out front, and She's
amazing.
Like a part-time kind of bartender, but she's also starting to do production a little bit. She's starting to organize events for us and stuff like that too.
Oh, so, that's fantastic. Yeah. I like her a lot.
Yeah, so it worked out well considering Sarah moved and then Carrie was looking for something to do. And now it's the same building and everything.
So, yeah. It's nice to see this little like community coming together for each other and kind of like the Rose Hill Neighborhood Association and like, I don't know, revitalization a little bit. Yeah. And
that's what it's, I totally agree with that. But that's what I, for a long time, I went to the Rose Hill Neighborhood Association meetings. They have their meetings on Tuesday nights, though, and that's supposed to be my day off. So I try to even come to this end of town. So I haven't gone to a meeting in a long time. But, you know, it is one of those things, though, too, where some people see it as a negative.
Sure, of course.
It's change.
Of course.
So actually, Thursday night, there is a lecture that's kind of been advertised by the Neighborhood Association about gentrification. So we're at the African-American Heritage room, I guess, in the Jefferson School or something like that. So there's
this Thursday.
So tomorrow, the 31st at 5 o'clock. So
I should go to that.
Yeah, and that's a number my friends are going. And just it's a tough situation.
It totally is. I feel like, I know everybody's got different opinions. I don't think you can prevent change. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
But as long as it's conscious and everybody's got a voice.
Yeah. And that's like, I started going to the Neighborhood Association meetings, both to introduce myself, but like to kind of get people to know me, but also kind of see who and what we are. And, you know, I think it got taken both ways. But when I told them that the group at the association meeting that we were opening a distillery, one of the first things I said is it's going to be a little bit higher end, so you don't have to worry about kids coming in and getting drunk or buying our spirits, stuff like that. But I think some people took that as a negative, as like it's gentrification. It's going to be a high-end place the neighbors aren't going to go to because it's too expensive and it's too hoity-toity for the people that have historically been in this neighborhood.
Sure.
And it's bringing all of these outsiders to go to it and stuff like that. So
That's true. It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. I mean, I admit it. It's and got outsiders, and we had outsiders on the 12th. Like, it's a huge issue because we are this small town in Virginia, and have become bucolic in the nation's eyes, and or you know, a good thing for a lot of people, different types of people. So it's definitely an issue.
Yeah.
I was very struck doing research, and this is a big switch, but I want to make sure I address it.
Mm-hmm.
When I was doing research on you, I came across this amazing article, and I actually sent it to my husband, and it was called "When Scientists Give Up."
Yeah, when I was on NPR.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What an amazing article, and it talked about how you became frustrated with what research got funded and how it kind of informed your life and made you make some decisions.
Yeah. So, and that is one of many things. I mean, actually, as we go through our conversation here, for me, there's very rarely one reason that I did something. Usually a lot of things adding up. And that's absolutely one of them. Kind of in the era where I got my PhD, that was the mid 90s going into the 2000s. And that was an era when at least federally funded biomedical research was literally being doubled. It was just a priority at that time of the Clinton administration and things of that sort. And it kind of continued on into the Bush administration too.
Hmm.
But so there was essentially a lot of money and there was expansion going on. So I viewed the biomedical enterprise perhaps through too rosy of a lens, because that's what I thought the world was like and was going to continue to be like.
Yeah.
Things change. I actually, so 9/11, 2001, with kind of both the Twin Towers falling, but the anthrax attacks too. A lot of money started pouring into biodefense, and that's why actually my specialty became anthrax. I became an anthrax specialist.
Huh.
And but then over the years, funding started getting tighter, less interest in biodefense. Actually, you know, as something fades away in memory, people pay less attention to it. Therefore, it means less money going towards it. And so the science I was doing became different in the sense that with the lack of money, it forced those groups that review scientific proposals, it forced them to become much more conservative with a little c. Like, basically, they wanted to have things, they prefer to fund things that were certainly going to work. And that takes a lot of fun out of it for me. I mean, I went into science to be doing cutting edge, in a sense, high risk, high reward type return things, rather than here's something that is 99% going to work. For me, that means what's the fun in that if it's likely to work? So I think I probably could have survived in that environment, but it wasn't fulfilling my emotional needs. And that's really what made me start thinking about doing something else.
I hear that so much. My husband works at UVA, and it's a lot of institutions want that sure thing because then they can have that name on the paper and look how successful this was because that brings in more money and donors and all that other stuff. And rather than taking the risk to see, let's try this research.
Yeah. And that's what it is also tied to kind of reputations and things of that sort, as you're kind of mentioning. But if you actually look at, and I've seen this, I think you could probably go to like Science or Nature magazine and read this, but most of the actual work done by scientists that won Nobel laureates were done before they were the age of 40. So it's people that don't have a track record that and it's people that don't have a track record, and it's people that are doing these high risk, high return things, because incremental doesn't give you a Nobel laureate. It's doing something completely new that makes a new field or is paradigm changing or something like that. So
we had that eureka moment.
Exactly.
You're farting around and you're like, oh my God, I cured cancer.
And so that's a pretty big argument to not be conservative in terms of what you fund, but also putting funds and resources into relatively young people's hands that haven't ossified and kind of gotten stuck they get a reputation as this type of person. It's a person that hasn't yet established the reputation, so they're able to follow what they think is best rather than defending past works or something of that sort.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Interesting. So you kind of said, microbiology, you're like, what else can I do with this?
Well, it's a longer story than that. And actually, it's full circle.
Well, you said, I read, you have such a passion for microbes.
Yeah. So, I've always been a scientist. I was even like, I still have the trophy that in seventh grade, I won the best student in science in my middle school and everything.
Cool.
And I did lots of things kind of through the rest of my life. But I think because of that, when I went into college, at the age of 18, I could buy barley, yeast, and hops, but I couldn't buy beer. So, so being a scientist and being a do-it-yourselfer, I started making beer in college. And
because why not?
Yeah, exactly. Because I was, in a sense, I was allowed to. Maybe allowed to have beer on the premise, like have the final product, but I could have all the ingredients.
Right.
And I went through a phase of making bad tasting beer. which I think probably happens eventually for everybody. So I took my first microbiology class in college, and I isolated all the microorganisms that were growing in my beer, and ends up most of them were from my mouth, because like I was mouth siphoning and things of that sort. So like in hindsight, I was being dumb, but I didn't like have this microbiology mindset yet. But then I took that microbiology course and I realized how much I liked it, and that kind of became my career. From basically that point forward. So making alcohol is what brought me into the biomedical sciences.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I got into microbiology that way. And I think on the website it says I make cheese, I cure meats. I do lots of microbiological stuff just at home also.
That's so interesting. And I bet all of that knowledge of like cheese and pickles and things like that informs you're making of spirits as well, because they all behave differently.
Yeah, and that's what I mean, there's a certain level of scientist in me where I try to control variables as much as possible, but you can only control so many things, and there's a certain amount of intuition that I've developed over what's decades now, in like three plus decades that I've been doing fermentations in some shape or form, and it becomes a little bit second nature in that regard too. So,
do you know PK over at Splendora's has a microbiology degree?
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
And she uses that to make gelato. So she did the other way. She got the degree and then ended up using the knowledge to make ice cream. It's not ice cream, I know. But you know what I mean, like frozen dessert.
Yeah.
So, and you kind of did the opposite.
Yep.
Started making beer and went, oh, this is fun. Let me learn more
I think that Splendora's thing has come up a couple of times because Carrie, who works out front, used to work at Splendora's too. And she brings up things that she used to see and do at Splendora's also.
Oh, so. And there's the community again.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing. Yeah. I kind of love that.
Yeah.
Like I talk to people and they go, oh, I know that guy. He worked here, here, and here.
Yep.
Like, it's very incestuous in a way, the way everybody's trades off each other.
And this may come up again, but literally 1 hour ago in that seat that you're sitting in were two guys from Mudhouse, Phil and Eric, that I'm working with to develop a coffee liqueur with them. We were talking about all these different methods of extraction and transferring the coffee flavor, the aromas versus the colors and things like
that. Like a Kahlua.
So, kind of something like that, yeah, because we'll start off with a rum base, which I'm pretty sure Kahlua is a rum base also, but it's going to be a Mudhouse roast, and it's going to be custom built for us.
Collaboration. So. Oh my God, that sounds delicious. When is that coming out?
I can't say for certain. Like, I mean, it's not like I'm not saying. I just don't know.
Still in development.
Yeah. I mean, we really started seriously discussing it essentially today. So
now
I have to look at my schedule. I have to tell them when I need them to deliver the ground beans. And I'm going to do a bunch of different versions of it in my little experimental still. And it's almost impossible for me to predict how long nor which direction kind of we're going to go with it. But
sure.
I mean, I'd like to have it by the holidays, but that's a little bit optimistic in terms of like typically with spirits, I can usually build the spirit within a month or two, but then all of the paperwork and whatever, getting it cleared with the federal government, getting labels made, and then doing the production and all that type of stuff is usually, it's much longer than just coming up with the recipes. So.
Okay. Then that was a question I had. Because I just talked to a Virginia distillery company about their single malt whiskey. How is distilling rum and liqueurs and gin different from bourbon and whiskey?
Quite a bit different.
Yeah, there's no barrels aging.
Well, that depends.
Teach me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So I would say the starting point is that the federal government has distinct guidelines and definitions of what different spirits are. So, and that to some degree defines what we can or must do in order to call it rum or in order to call it a liqueur.
Okay.
And there's basically a big long list. It's chapter 4. In the beverage alcohol manual, if you want to look it up, but you can just type it in Google and find it too. But so whiskey, as a huge broad category, is a spirit made from grains.
Okay.
A rum is a spirit that's made from basically any sort of sugarcane product. So that can either be cane juice. That's what basically you just squish sugar canes, the juice that comes out of you, ferment that. That's what cachaça is, or rum agricole from the French Caribbean. Historically, rum has more frequently, especially in the American colonies, was usually made from molasses because that's a byproduct of using sugarcane juice to then produce white table sugar. So basically brown sugar is white table sugar that still has some molasses essentially in it.
Okay.
And to make the white sugar, you have to pull out all that brownness, and that's essentially what molasses is. So so using a waste product to make a spirit is a reasonable thing to do. I mean, it's basically a relatively cheap thing. It's got lots of sugar in it that you can convert into alcohol, and that's a rum. Liqueurs aren't defined by their sugar source in the sense. They're defined by what flavoring you put into that liqueur, as well as it has to have at least 2.5% sugar to call it a liqueur.
Okay.
So our orange liqueur, the flavor is primarily from oranges. We use both navel oranges as a sweet orange, and then we balance that with the hardy orange, which grows around Virginia.
Yeah, I did not. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I read that on your website, and I was like, oh,
yeah,
because I know Harrison over at Keevil, he was he wants to use local, but he can't find citrus.
Yeah, and so that's there's a little bit of a twist on that, and that's solely that the hardy orange is in the bitter orange realm, so the juice and pulp are essentially non-edible.
Okay.
Like, it's one of those things that's so bitter and sour. The only time I've ever really seen it used as a food stuff is when people make marmalade out of it. You know, it's
yeah, bitter
like
orange marmalade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like that's kind of the realm. And that's why we don't actually use the pulp in any shape or form. We zest it. So we pull off the exterior.
Okay.
And that has a very fruity, but I wouldn't say classically citrus aroma. It's a little bit actually in the passion fruit, kind of a musky zone.
Oh, interesting.
And yeah, so that gives us both a little bitterness, but also a slightly different orangey fruitiness than what you'd get from your average triple sec or something like that.
Interesting.
So so liqueurs have to have at least 2.5% sugar, but then the flavoring basically defines its name. If you add coffee to it, it's a coffee liqueur.
Mm-hmm.
There's some exceptions to that too. Like we're actually this Friday, we're releasing our Anisette is the name of it, but that's an anise liqueur, much like a pastis or like a Pernod pastis or an ouzo or a sambuca or a raki. There's a bunch of different names for it. Or aguardiente is another name for it from South America.
Hmm.
So it's complex in terms of what things can be called. I think the only thing I really, the two things I haven't mentioned were brandies. So a brandy is made from any fruit wine. So you can make brandy out of grapes, which is the most typical. That's actually, I'd say, the default. If someone says brandy, that usually means grape juice brandy.
Okay.
But apples count, pears count.
Brandy, yeah.
All those things are
peach,
brandies.
Peach, pear.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then
like
the final thing, the really big thing is vodka. And vodka is weird because that can be from any fermentable source. Anywhere where you can get starch or sugar, you can make a vodka. So I've seen carrot vodkas. I've seen potato.
What?
I've seen grape.
Carrot.
So what vodka is actually defined by the production process. So vodka, in terms of the federal government, is something that comes off the still at over 95% pure. So it's 95% alcohol or over 190 proof and tasteless. Those are the two definitions of vodka. So
okay.
Those are basically all the broad categories of alcohol that's out there.
Wow, that's so interesting. Now, would a grape vodka, is that similar to grappa or completely different?
Completely different.
Completely
so,
different.
So grape vodka is, it starts off as grape wine. Grappa, on the other hand, is another recycling methodology.
It's from the must.
Yeah. So it's basically all of the stems and skins and all that type of stuff.
Okay.
That usually at a winery, they actually, so they press wine. They press those things to get wine out of it, but they don't do it at very high pressure. They don't do very high PSI for that, because if you go at really high pressure, you start getting really bitter and kind of nasty flavors out of it.
Hmm.
So they press all those things very lightly. They get good wine out of it, and that turns into wine. But then the truth of the matter is, there's lots of alcohol left in there. So if they press it really hard, they can get a bitter substance to come out of it.
Yeah.
And that's what can be turned into grappa. Or you can actually take all those solids, just throw them right into your still, and then as you heat it up, the alcohol comes out of all those solids and turns into grappa. So that's why grappa tends to be pretty rough around the edges.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of the... Once again, like molasses, it's like the waste of the production process of another thing.
Oh, I've had some good ones, though.
Oh, yeah.
I mention it to every distiller I talk to, because I'm hoping Virginia will relax its regulations a bit.
So do you know that, like, Mount Domaine, south on 20, they make grappa?
No kidding.
There. Yeah.
They do?
Yes.
That's a first.
But that being said...
it's not...
No. They actually, I think they just got pulled from the ABC store shelves.
Frick.
Because there wasn't enough people buying it.
Oh.
So it didn't meet its minimum sales requirements and stuff.
Well, and you know what? It is a hard sell. It's... When I first tasted it, I was like, oh my God, this is fire water, moonshine.
Yeah.
I cannot drink it.
Yeah.
And then my husband and I stumbled into a grappa bar.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we just happened to happen upon it, and over the course of an evening, a very rowdy evening, watching soccer, we had some tastings, yeah. And I became a huge fan, yeah. Because there are some lovely ones.
And I was going to say, and it's one of those things where there's so many different grappas made, that especially if you go to Italy.
Oh,
there's,
yes.
There's fantastic ones, and they do aged ones. They do ones that have been flavored a little bit with fruits and everything like that, too. But if they're done right, they're great.
Yeah.
It's just that it is one of the more challenging ones, so getting it done right is more rare than a bunch of other kind of spirits and things of that sort. So you have to find them.
I'd like to taste that one that got pulled.
Yeah.
Curious.
And that's what I forgot the gentleman's name, but I met him at the Heritage Harvest Festival up at Monticello. And he basically kind of, we talked about it and everything like that.
It's like my white whale, the grappa in Virginia. I'm like, there's so much wine. There's no grappa. Come on.
Well, that's what, that being said, though, I do a fair amount of contract distilling for wineries where they give me their wine and I turn it into brandy, but then I give it back to them and they make fortified wines, like port style wines and stuff like that.
Oh, nice.
And we're legally allowed to do that. Like, I have to send basically I have to get a letter from the ABC saying I'm allowed to give them back the spirits and stuff like that. But as long as they're putting it in a product that is below 20% alcohol, so like that's within their licensure, it's all legit to basically do that way. So I've done it for at least four different wineries now in the region. So
that's so cool.
Yeah.
So maybe it'll happen at some point.
Yeah.
Maybe some collaboration, more collaboration happening. And when you were speaking of rum, can you ever make rum out of sorghum?
You can make a spirit out of sorghum.
Or a spirit out of sorghum.
Yeah, but you can't
call
it
rum.
Because it's
even though it's sweet or sugar.
It's basically because of those federal definitions.
Oh, I gotcha.
And so I have friends. They're Fair Game Beverage, which is down just outside of Carrboro, North Carolina. I have a friend there that he and I took a distilling class together in Chicago. And he makes a rum-like product that he calls Nolasses. Because he uses sorghum molasses, and that grows around here, so that'd be great to use.
Yeah.
But we can't call it rum, and it falls under this category in the federal government called a distilled spirit specialty, which basically means you have to come up with a fanciful name for it, like my friend's Nolasses. There's another company that calls it sorghum, but that's like trademarked and things of that sort, so no one else can use that. So it's in terms of product, it's a little bit of a difficult sell communicating to people what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But the final product is quite similar to sugarcane rums.
I just discovered sorghum myself a couple years ago, and I'm a huge fan. I get it. You have to sell people on the product and what it is before they'll...
And I actually have been approached by a number of local farmers about it, and I like the idea. But I have to be frank, as a businessman, though, too, I'm using molasses, sugarcane molasses right now, that's a waste product. 90% of molasses made in the United States goes into animal feed because they can't even find a place to put it. Whereas sorghum molasses is much smaller producers, and there's not as much of an infrastructure to get it to us. So at a financial level, on a per pound basis, sorghum molasses is a lot, 10 plus times more expensive.
Yeah.
So if we make a product, we'd have to charge a heck of a lot more from it. And then as a businessman making a very expensive product that has no immediate market right now, that we'd have to build the entire market, that basically scares me. Like, it's not, it's a little bit too much of a risk for me to initially jump in and do something like that.
Right. So let's talk about the business side of it. 'Cause you're over here on Henry Avenue, and your business, people will buy a bottle of rum or gin, probably not every week, every month.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are you doing to get the word out that you're open and ready to roll and here I am and come visit me?
There's lots of things. But one thing I should say, though, and this was like in my business plan, is that we want to maintain authenticity as best as possible.
Sure.
So I would really like, my ideal way of growth is essentially word of mouth. And that has to be promoted in a lot of different ways, but basically I will never be buying NFL football spot, even if I could afford it, because that's not like, I want it to feel like a garage band situation where like people recognize this as their kind of own private personal thing.
I like that.
And so that means we have to keep in touch with our customers and things of that sort. And so the primary way that I would actually say word spreads is in person. We do lots of festivals. I do probably 6 to 8 tastings a month at ABC stores. We do some advertising, like we're on NPR. We do a little bit in Seville Weekly. We do lots of festivals. It's actually becoming festival season now. So it being Virginia Spirits Month this month in September, basically every single weekend I have 2 festivals that we're doing. We're sponsoring the Free Fall concert series in the Ix Park that WTJU
puts on.
So we'll be at every one of those concerts.
I'm going
on
to the Saturday.
Yeah, so I should be at that one too.
Yeah, man, Black Masala, they're so great.
Exactly. So so I do that. Also, I have a solicitor's license. So that means I can walk into restaurants, also known as bars in Virginia, since bars don't exist in Virginia.
Right.
But so I walk into, if I pulled up the list, I've been to over 120 restaurants now where I walk in with my suitcase, I open my suitcase, have all the bottles there, and I pour tastings for bartenders and stuff like that too.
Like the Fuller Brush Man of rum.
Yeah. And that's what, so that's our approach. And I have to say that that's not, that's not completely only my idea. So my family also has 2 wineries that were built by my brother. And so he needed investors and so forth. So the rest of the family invested money. And so that means to some degree I was involved with the wineries and my whole family is. And both of my brother's wineries are successful now. And I have this group that's been basically working in the alcohol industry for 12-ish years now. And they've become my board. So this is a family-owned business, but everybody's on that board is my family and has been in the alcohol business for a while. And so we're, to some degree, taking what we learned from the wineries and applying that to the spirits business. And my brother really feels that one of the things that made his wineries successful was him, like the owner, the winemaker in that case, being the face for the company for years and years and years. And that's exactly what I'm doing. Like, I am the face walking into those restaurants. I am the one pouring stuff at those festivals. I'm the one pouring taste at the ABC stores. And it's rare to see that. I mean, there's usually a sales rep or something like that.
A brand ambassador.
Yeah. And obviously they're very good at what they do.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, I'm the founder. I've been here since year -4.
Yeah.
And
yes.
I've gone through the whole process. I produced the stuff. Yeah. I know all the thoughts behind it. And you can't, like, that cannot be communicated into a salesperson or something like that.
No.
And so that's what, like, when I'm doing tasting stuff like that, I pretty quickly kind of let it slip that, yeah, when I make this or when I was founding the company, everyone's like, oh my God, you're the one that makes this stuff. And that sinks in. And then I can kind of communicate my vision, my enthusiasm, all that type of stuff. And it's much more authentic than any salesperson could do.
You know, that's so true, because I went to a whiskey festival years ago, and the girl pouring, it was when Bullet first kind of hit big. And the girl pouring it made a point of telling me that she was the great-granddaughter of the founder. And it made it taste better.
Yeah, right.
It totally did. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. Pouring out, you know.
Yeah.
The story, brand
and
story.
Context matters. And so that's why we do tours on the weekends.
Yeah.
Because if I get someone in the tour, there's so much more context that when they come out of there and they start tasting our neutral things, they can taste all the things that I was talking about in the tour when they taste our spirits straight or whatever. And when people are more tuned in, it makes appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think one of the things that kind of made the beer industry boom was that people started making a lot of beer at home. And when you're that intimate with something, you appreciate the good stuff. And it makes you more interested in it and everything like that. So that's I really wish that distilling at home wasn't illegal. Because that's a barrier for us. Like when I was first starting to talk to people about starting this distillery, I'd say I'm opening a distillery. And they'd go, oh, what type of IPA are you going to make? And I'm like, I don't make beer. because it was, people were familiar with beer and craft beer production and things of that sort. That's the only thing that was kind of in there on the radar at that moment. And distilling is a whole new world that people aren't familiar with. And there's not a really legal way for them to become intimate with it either.
God, that's so interesting. I would love to go back in a time machine and talk to like the guys down in Franklin County and, you know, areas like that about their process and what, if they were looking for like a certain flavor or something.
Oh,
or
I'm sure. I mean, those guys had so much hands-on experience and they got, well, and it was their livelihood too. So like if they got a reputation as making the good stuff, they were set for life, and then they could pass down that knowledge to their kid and it'd be a family business from there on out and everything. Yeah. So,
well, and heck, time machine. I had some last Christmas. So not really like it's gone out of style or nothing.
There's still tons of it out there, I'm sure.
It's like, around.
Yeah. And honestly, when I'm kind of in the startup phase of the distillery, when I was kind of, you know, I didn't, in the early stages, there were periods where I wasn't super active. So like I went to the Chartsville Historical Society library and started going through, basically doing searches on spirits and distilling and stuff like that. And I found an article on, I think it was 1983, over in Woolen Mills. They caught a moonshiner.
83?
Yeah. And it was kind of a sad story because the moonshiner's son brought some of the hooch to school, and like he was going to get to friends and got caught and stuff that. So then it traced back to his dad. but in the article, they said it was one of the most beautiful stills they'd ever seen. So I called up the Charlottesville Police Department and I said, I have an article here from 1983. What did you do with that still? Because I can use it legally if you guys can get it for me. And they put me in touch with the actual officer did the bust and everything. He's higher up now and everything. But he's like, no, we put an axe through it and gave it to a museum or something like that. But I was that would have been so great if I had like a historical still from Charlottesville that I could make stuff with out front and everything.
You know, there's one down at VDC.
Oh, really? Like an old time one?
From Nelson County.
Oh, wow.
The guy donated it.
Oh, great.
I think they gave him like free tours for life or something in exchange. It's beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
It's
cool.
Yep. Just to see it and look at it is kind of neat. but what makes your rums and gin unique? Yeah. Like when you're distilling, what flavors and qualities are you looking for?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is the art of distillation. That's part of it. What I would say is different, though, is that classically, rums have been distilled to be aged in barrels. And you distill it differently if you want it to be drank at a younger age. And so for both business reasons, but also because I think it's a tasty spirit, our white rum, for instance, I distill it in a manner so that I eliminate all of the rough edges as best as possible so that it's ready to drink right now. Which means I throw a lot of it down the drain because all those rough edges are gallons. And those rough edges are usually rounded out by putting in a barrel for a bunch of years or something like that. So that's part of it. I throw a lot down the drain. I also do very clean fermentations. So basically complex biology inside of a fermentation, if you have lots of different organisms growing in a fermentation, yields complex aromas and chemistry also.
Okay.
So for instance, classically to make Jamaican rums, they use what's called dunder, which is basically compost. They have a big kind of pool where they throw all of their waste molasses in. It ferments out under the sun, and every now and then they'll grab a scoop of that stuff and throw it in their fermentation. So it's a very complex community of bacteria, of yeast. I've even heard of dead animals being in there and stuff like that.
No kidding.
So that's why that ultimately comes out in the end as high ester rum. Jamaican rums are known as high ester rums because esters being a fragrant chemical, those are often derived from reactions that happen when you have lots of bacteria in your fermentation. So in a sense, we make a very clean, straightforward rum because we pasteurize our molasses, so we kill everything that's in it, and then add our yeast back to it. So our yeast is essentially the only thing growing in there. And we're very meticulous about cleaning out our tanks and all that type of stuff and being clean. So that's one of the things that makes our rum different. Hmm. We also use a, for our rums, we use basically what's considered the highest grade molasses. It's not actually technically a molasses. It's more like an evaporated sugarcane juice. Hmm. It's sometimes referred to as sugarcane honey.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's super sweet and flavorful in the positive sense. Most molasses are derived from boiling down sugarcane juice, and they pull out the sugar crystals, so the sugar content keeps on getting dropped as they pull out sugar crystals.
Okay.
And they cook it more and more. So like Blackstrap is basically the lowest grade molasses, and that has relatively little sugar. It's really dark because it's been cooked for a long time, and that means you can kind of get kind of burnt and sulfury flavors and things of that sort.
Right, right.
And that's the lowest grade. But we basically have the completely, almost completely uncooked, just evaporated juice so that we don't get a lot of those bitter or sulfury aromas, even starting off from our molasses as well.
Hmm.
That's kind of our rum. I do barrel age rums too, and I kind of use dirtier distillation for the stuff that we put in our barrels.
Hmm.
Because like I said, those rough edges develop over time and actually become positive flavors. They go from being hot and burning into flavor diversity.
Sure.
And depth. So yeah, I have rum in bourbon barrels and Cabernet Franc barrels aging away. Lovely. Right now.
Lovely. And how long will that age?
You know, it's subjective.
Till it's ready.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to start taking it seriously after 2 years, I would say. But I'm going to taste it and see.
Yeah.
The downside of that in the city proper, though, is that I have flammable liquid limits here.
Oh, right.
So I can only have a certain number of flammable liquid gallons on the premises. And that makes it so I can only really have about 6 barrels at a time, because I need all the rest of those gallons basically for our daily operations and everything like that. So we're going to have very small barreled rum output. It's going to be a distiller's reserve, essentially, only sure. available at the distillery.
Sure.
I won't be able to sell it all over the state or anything like that. So.
That's a draw, though.
It's going to be exclusive
and yeah. nice and, yeah. and lovely.
And I can only hope that it stands up to the, like it has the taste to back yeah. up that exclusivity also. So. Yeah, we'll see.
And what about Vitae Gin?
Yeah, so that's different in a lot of ways.
Yeah, because I've read you do more of an herbal gin rather
yeah,
than a
so,
heavy juniper.
Yeah, so first off, our gin we call modern gin.
Okay.
And that's because I see it as a bit of an evolution away from classic London dry gins. And classic London dry gins are driven by juniper berries. Like that is the most yeah. pronounced flavor in there. And we have juniper berries. You actually have to have juniper berries by law, if you want to call it gin. That's one of the guidelines of the federal government. But on top of those juniper berries, we have 17 other different botanicals. Mm. And some of it is lemongrass from friends' backyards. We get ginger from a farm in Powhatan. We get cilantro, mint. We use lavender flowers.
Wow.
We use the hardy orange that we use for the orange liqueur. We put that in the gin. So the botanical makeup is different. But another thing that is really rare, and actually I'm trying to find anyone that still does it this way, but our base alcohol, once again, is molasses derived. There were a few other distilleries in the United States doing that, but they've all switched away from that because making a molasses spirit, essentially a molasses vodka, is much more expensive than what is usually used, which is a grain spirit. So usually a neutral grain spirit is made from the cheapest grains you can get, which is like corn and wheat.
Mm-hmm.
So on a per gallon basis, it's about 5 times less expensive to make a gin using grain spirits than our molasses version of it.
Hmm.
And so we basically start off with a rum, but then I put it through the still actually for a fourth time, and I'm really stringent on it so that it comes out at about 95% pure, which means I strip out a lot of the rum characteristics. There's a little bit left over. But then that's the base for our gin. And I find that molasses-based spirit changes the mouthfeel of it quite a bit, where there's a little bit of residual kind of caramel flavors that you get from the rum. And our brain interprets that as a little bit of sweetness, even though there's no sugar in there. But that little bit of sweetness rounds out the palate so that all those herbs and citrus and things of that sort are much better balanced, rather than having an initial spirit that's corn and wheat, where it's like really linear, and I find a little bit too lean tasting.
Wow, that sounds lovely. I'm a big fan of
gin.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if you like saw martinis on our website, and things.
But we just won a silver medal in the San Francisco World Spirits.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, so wonderful.
Yeah, which is great. So like that's basically the most prestigious competition in the world.
Oh, congratulations.
So, yeah, so
when you got a bronze medal for your rum.
Yeah, that's right. So both of our golden rum and our platinum rum both got bronzes, and our gin got the silver.
That's so great.
Yeah.
And again, awards and recognition can drive your business.
Absolutely.
That's so great.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I want to talk about your family for a little bit, because you did come to Vitae with a lot of knowledge from with the two wineries.
Yep.
Where did you grow up, and when did the winery start? Were you out there helping, like pruning? Or
so? Yeah, I mean, ultimately I was, but I don't even know where to start. So wine came on the scene, actually, I would say mainly when I was in graduate school getting my PhD at Berkeley in California. So I was living in the Bay Area. And about that same time, my brother had a career change too. It was too early in life. He was in his early, mid-30s at the time. So it wasn't like a midlife crisis. But he wanted to do a career change. And he became a winemaker in the Santa Cruz Mountains, just south of San Francisco. And he basically went from the bottom all the way up to become... I'm not sure if he was the winemaker. He might have been like co-winemaker or something like that. But he basically went up the ranks really quickly and became essentially a winemaker at a really well-renowned Pinot Noir house in the Santa Cruz Mountains, David Bruce Winery. And so when my brother Eric was working down there, I'd basically hang out. I'd help him bottle things, things of that sort. And eventually, as with most people, he wanted to ultimately go off on his own. And that's when he started kind of looking for investors, which ended up being mostly the family. And he decided, though, that he wanted to go back to what he considered was his home in northern Arizona. Before he became a winemaker, he was a riverway restoration ecologist. So he did lots of work all over the state of California, of Arizona.
Yeah.
Basically doing riparian riverway studies and restoration and things of that sort. And he was convinced that he knew microclimates in Arizona that'd be good to grow grapes. Arizona's a huge state with massive geologic diversity. And the cost of land is like 1/50th of what it costs in California. So that's why he decided to start the wineries down there. And I became involved both at the practical level, where I kind of set up their laboratory and things of that sort. I worked in the field. I worked one harvest season, like kind of working the 18-hour days, driving trucks and things of that sort. And then as I moved on and I went to my professorship at the University of Virginia, I kind of became less practical, but I remained on the board of directors. And every 6 months, basically, we have a family reunion, which is the board of directors meeting for the wineries down in Arizona, and that at least gets our family together twice a year. And that's executive level stuff. That's kind of like bigger picture things that we discuss there, rather than like fine operational details or something like that.
So, right.
Yeah.
God, that's amazing. That's so much knowledge.
Yeah. Well, but also there's that wine industry knowledge, but there's a huge amount of overlap between my science. Basically, my science training and what I do here, too. Like, I use the exact same notebooks that I used to use in my microbiology infectious disease lab as I do here. And it's just different scales. But like I said, I use my scientific technique to kind of work out problems and change one variable at a time and see how that affects things, and basically having hypotheses and testing them and stuff like that. So,
well, and before opening a distillery, what kind of research did you do? Did you travel around and observe like how others did it?
Yeah. And in terms of like me learning about the distillery business.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all of the above. So I did, when I decided I wanted to do it, there's a certain amount of practical research I had to do. So I started talking to still manufacturers and stuff like that. And they basically then connected me with other distilleries that had their still or whatever. So I basically did a huge road trip where I was going around from distillery to distillery, both looking at their stills, but talking to all these people that are running distilleries also. And it was mostly the Southeast and the South, because I went to distilleries. I also went to the sugar mills to learn about the sugar industry also.
Right.
And try to set up relationships with the sugar mills. It ends up that molasses being a waste product and me being a relatively small business, it doesn't make sense for them logistically to send me molasses directly. So I more get it from like a central depot. But so I went to distilleries directly. I went straight to the sugarcane fields. Hmm. I also did a course with the Cybele Institute, which is the oldest brewing school in the United States. It's in Chicago. Like they were established in the late 1800s. And they run courses now on distillation too.
Really?
So I did a certificate, and it's relatively short, but I basically did a certificate on craft distilling and operations.
Hmm.
And honestly, that was less technical in terms of distillation. It was more about the business. It was kind of like dealing with the laws, dealing with marketing, dealing with like fire code, things of that sort.
Right.
So it wasn't such practical hands-on distillation, but it was the business part and all that type of stuff. So
that's the learning curve I'm having right now. Because
yeah.
It was one thing to learn podcasting, but then all the stuff that surrounds it as far as business licenses and zoning and all this other mess.
And it's there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
I think that's what catches a lot of people, probably to me to some degree too, catches people off guard is like, I'm a great distiller. That means I can have a business, but there's so much more to it that
absolutely.
Is way beyond just having a good product.
Yeah. So. A good product, a good idea, a good brand name or whatever.
Yep.
And I love the artwork on your labels.
Oh, yeah.
It's beautiful.
And that's really a collaboration by a team. So I worked with Convoy. They're a design company that's downtown.
They're good. Yeah, they're really good.
But that being said, like, there's botanical art on there. We have a friend that is actually, we met her essentially because she's the wife of one of my wife's colleagues, Laura Call Gastinger, who is a local botanical artist. And we basically commissioned her to do hand-done drawings of plants and things of that sort for all of our bottles.
Nice.
And that's what's on our wall in the tasting room now. I'm talking to her right now. She's going to be doing art classes at the distillery where she's going to basically have classes where she's going to teach pen and sepia botanical drawing and everything like that. Yeah, too.
Oh, I love that overlap. That's so cool.
So that's just, we had Lara on board. We had Convoy on board.
That's way better than the, was it paint me, color me mine, paint with wine thing.
Yeah.
I would much rather have some artisanal gin and learn how to do a pen and ink drawing of a leaf.
And then honestly,
that's
too.
That's incredible.
Both for the bottles, but also the look of our tasting room too. My wife, who's also a business partner, she's in the design realm professionally. She's a landscape architect over at Nelson Bird Waltz. So I call her my chief aesthetics officer because, like, really, she makes a lot of the executive decisions about, like, how it all comes together and works with Convoy and Lara and our architect for the tasting room out front and things of that sort. Because I'm a little bit too pragmatic for those things. I'm kind of like, A, how much is it going to cost? B, is it going to break? And if it passes, like, those tests, then I let I let the other people start dealing with the aesthetics a little bit more and everything like that. So,
well, and the logo's really cool too. I feel like that there's a story there.
Yeah, so that's, I think we can attribute that to Convoy.
Okay.
So
it looks like a chemical atom thing.
Our brand that's an ethanol molecule.
Oh, okay.
So that's two carbons and oxygen and a bunch of hydrogens.
Okay.
And
nice.
The whole
kind
of the label is kind of playing on my scientific scientist past, where it's supposed to kind of look like Darwin's journal as he's traveling around the world, both doing sketches of the things that he's seeing and things of that sort. But then, like, the look of it, I mean, I have my initials at the bottom and the batch number, where it's supposed to look like kind of like a regimented entry.
Yeah.
And that's why that's also playing with, like, our actual mark is the ethanol molecule.
Hmm.
And that's what we... It's whatever, it's on our stationery and all those type of things and stuff too.
When vitae is Latin for life or living?
It's kind of life. So it's really derived from aqua vitae, water of life.
Oh, gotcha.
And
see, that, and that's what I get when I read the name, when I see the logo. I went to Amsterdam and went to aqua vitae bar.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they had the little herbal I don't know, elixirs? I don't know what you call them. But, oh my God, it was amazing.
Yeah, and that's there's a really long history of alcohol being associated with as a medicine or with a medicine or things of that sort. I mean,
or suspended in alcohol. Like,
Well, that's what, I'm not sure if you ran into this story, but weirdly enough, the distillation process was discovered by Muslim alchemists. So, you know, like all, basically if you think about alcohol, all other alcohols could be spontaneous production, like mead, beer, wine, all those things kind of could happen on their own. But distillations required technological development. We basically had to have good enough metal and things of that sort to make stills. And so basically, in the, they think it's somewhere in the 1200s to 1300s, during an era, honestly, where the Islamic world was the most advanced, the alchemists were looking for the elixir of life, the sorcerer's stone, something that will keep them young forever. And so they built the first alembic still. Almost anything that starts, any word that starts off with A-L came from Arabic. So alembic stills, alcohol, that's derived from Arabic.
So interesting.
And they put wine in an alembic still, a colorless liquid came out, and then they put a pear in it, and that pear never rotted. And we know now know that alcohol is a preservative. It keeps microbes from rotting things, but microbial theory wasn't established at that point. So they interpreted that as that liquid was infusing life force into that pear and keeping it from rotting. And thus, when that was brought into Europe, that's aqua vitae, water of life.
Water of life.
And that became uscabahe, which became whiskey in Gaelic, became aquavit in Scandinavia, became eau de vie in France. And that's kind of, that's kind of the derivative of a lot of that, a lot of that. And that's why it was kind of in the world of, you know, kind of alchemists kind of became our early proto-doctors, chemists. And so alcohol was brought into this world of medicine. And that's why like chartreuse and absinthe and all those things made like absinthe made with wormwood. It's called wormwood because it has artemisinin in it. And that's to this day an anti-worm medication. Yeah. So like all, a lot of those herbal alcohols that still exist today were originally made as medicinal compounds, basically.
That is so interesting to me. And I know after enough absinthe, you feel like you could live forever. I've had the real stuff. Or I guess they've kind of relaxed their rules on that a little bit.
You can have a little bit.
You can.
And, yeah, they test it, though.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, you have to send in samples and make sure it passes the test before you can release it.
It's a shame. There was, I've been to some great absinthe bars that have some very rare Swiss. I prefer the Swiss ones. And they're just lovely.
Oh, yeah. And they're
so delicious.
Complex, and it's really capturing a lot of the essence of those herbs and everything in there, too. It preserves them. It's like,
You
can taste them long after their season has passed. Yeah. So,
any chance that could happen in Virginia?
Yes. I've been battling
with
the TTB. That's
You're an absinthe warrior.
Well,
I like it.
So what we weren't going to call it an absinthe. It's basically a collaboration I did with Micah Lamone from Alleylight.
Oh, cool.
And we kind of we pulled a bunch of herbs and spices and stuff out of the woods from around here. And we made a really good herbal liqueur. We didn't have the intention of making it absinthe-y, per se. It did have some wormwood in it. But we had so many weird things in it that the TTB, the TTB is what replaced the ATF. They're basically our federal regulatory organization. So that TTB stands for the Taxation of Alcohol and Tobacco Board, or something like that. And they, I basically, you have to submit your formulas, your recipes to them before you can start producing anything in reality. And they balked at a number of the herbs and spices in there and sent it to, they basically said I had to get the generally recognized as safe numbers for those substances from the FDA. And then I went to the FDA and the FDA said, that's not our responsibility. It's your responsibility as a producer to guarantee everything you make is safe. So we're not going to give you numbers. And then I go back to TTV and tell them that. And I'm basically caught between two huge institutions that say it's the other institution's responsibility to give you the okay.
Okay.
So as of this moment, I've basically dropped like three ingredients that they were unwilling to approve. But now I have to build the liqueur again to see if it tastes good.
Sure, yeah.
now that those ingredients aren't in there.
Yeah.
So it's a long process.
Oh, but that's a shame.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that do that. I can maybe do a plug, though, for one of... So I'm not sure if you know Spirits Lab. They're the other distillery in Charlottesville proper. Hmm. And they got their license about 2 weeks before us. And they just released... I think it's called Forage. It's an Amaro. So it's kind of a...
Oh, wow.
It's kind of an herbal fruit liqueur. And I know that he's put pawpaws in it. I think he's put a lot of herbs from the woods and stuff like that in there. So,
hooray!
Yeah. So,
I've never heard of them. That's new to me.
I think he released it 2 weeks ago.
Nice.
So that's around also as an option. So.
Yeah, we need to tell people, where can we find Vitae Spirits?
So that's what we're certainly at the distillery. We sell bottles. We give tastings. We make cocktails. We're in very many Virginia ABC stores. All of the ones in the Charlottesville area, very many of the ones going up 29 to Northern Virginia, and then very many going down 64 kind of through Richmond to the Tidewater. We're not in Western Virginia all that much. There just hasn't been the demand for it really out there. But you can see that on our website. I keep a pretty up-to-date map with all the ABC stores, and there's a second map on there that actually has all the restaurants I know about to make cocktails with our products too. So you can actually go on our map and click on that. Basically all of the really good cocktail places in Charlottesville and Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're starting kind of in Northern Virginia, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Most of those places you can at least get some of our products made into cocktails too.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're having a cocktail competition, I saw.
Yeah, that's right. So basically, and it's due by September 4th. And there's kind of rules to it, but we're promoting amateur mixologists or bartenders to submit recipes, so that whoever the winner is, we'll put that on our fall seasonal menu, seasonal cocktail menu, and they'll be basically the featured cocktail for the fall season.
Oh, that's nice.
It's a little bit complicated by, Virginia alcohol rules, which is partly that, we can only serve alcohol produced on the premises, so it can only be made with things that we've produced. You can't use alcohol from anywhere else, nor can you use any alcohols less than 20% alcohol, so you can't use vermouths or anything like that.
Oh.
We can only put in a maximum of 1.5 ounces of alcohol per drink, which I think that's actually the standard federal size of a cocktail, but a lot of places these days go a little bit higher than that. So those are some of the kind of guidelines that we have to follow. But yeah, hopefully we'll get a bunch of good ideas coming in.
Yeah, I know. I started thinking, like, kind of coming up with stuff. My favorite cocktail, we share this. I love daiquiris.
Oh, yeah.
A good daiquiri.
And it's, a lot of people say the daiquiri and the old fashioned are like the two drinks. If you go into a bar and order that, that'll tell you whether you have a good bartender or not. Because they're so simple that you really have to know what you're doing to get it right. You have to use good ingredients, fresh ingredients. And like, I love me a good daiquiri.
Oh, me too. I had a Papa Doble in Key West.
Uh-huh.
And the guy, he's probably 80 years old. And he said, I learned to make this at the bar in Havana where Papa Hemingway drank.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was that story again.
Yeah, right.
And so on my first sip, I'm like, I just went to heaven. Oh my God, this is perfect.
And Hemingway used to put down like five doubles at a time or something like that too. So
I can't. Those are strong drinks.
I know.
Well, how do you make a good daiquiri for folks at home? This is not, we're not talking strawberry banana.
No, it's the
classic. A straight classic well-made daiquiri.
So honestly, if I say it honestly, my recipe I actually got from the Death & Company cocktail book, which is 2 ounces of a really good white rum, like our platinum rum, an ounce of completely fresh squeezed lime. You can't use like frozen stuff or anything like that. And then 3/4 ounce of a 1-to-1 simple syrup. So
okay.
A simple syrup that's made with 1 cup water, 1 cup sugar.
Okay.
And that's what I start at. Honestly, I like mine just a tad bit tartar, so I don't quite put in quite that much sugar.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a phenomenal drink because it's refreshing, but it doesn't hide the rum, too. I really like rum, so I don't like hiding it with a bunch of pineapple or coconut or something like that,
right,
if I don't have to,
right,
or Coca-Cola. So
right.
Yeah, so just a little bit of lime and a little bit of sugar, and that's ready to go.
Very nice. Yeah. Very nice. Best enjoyed on your days off. Do you have any days off? I'm working on my segues. That's why I just did that.
Yeah. I mean, I do. I mean, I'm supposed to take Mondays and Tuesdays off. Yeah. But
oh, that's right. You
said
Tuesday.
If you're trying to get a hold of me, I was working all day Monday and I was working all day Tuesday. But those, honestly, psychologically, like, I take the days a little bit easier. Like,
yeah,
I mean, I just, like,
right,
I don't, like, get up quite as early. I don't get in quite as early.
What do you enjoy doing on your time off?
You know, I do a lot. I'm a cyclist, so I do. I do road biking when I can.
That's,
I do a
great
lot
around
of hiking.
Here.
I do just kind of walks in the woods. When if it's raining out and all that type of stuff, I do lots of reading. I mean, I still get a little bit of home microbiology in, but much less. Because I kind of get my microbiology fix a lot from here now.
Here, yeah.
But we have a friend that gives us. She raises show goats. So she gives us
show goats.
Yeah. So she has
like a dog show, but for
goats.
Yeah,
and she's a judge too, like for 4-H and other things like that.
Oh, okay.
So but and it's a rare breed of goat. It's I guess it's called I think it's called La Mancha. They don't have ears, and it's the only variety that was developed in America.
Oh, interesting.
But so she has all this goat milk, unpasteurized. So we pick it up on a regular basis, and we still make lots of goat cheese on a regular basis. It's mostly my wife, but I happily eat it. So
yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, this has been terrific. Did we cover everything? Was there anything? We covered a lot.
Yeah.
I feel like we did. I'm kind of ready for a cocktail now. I'm sitting here thinking I need to pick up some of that rum.
Well, and that's we always have a rotating menu of cocktails too. We have some really good ones right now.
Yeah, and the tasting room's open like 2 to 9.
Yeah. So. Like
Wednesday
I think we
to su- was it Wednesday to
Wednesday
Saturday?
To Friday.
Wednesday Friday
is 2 to 9. Saturday we're open our maximal legal hours, which is 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., and then our maximal legal hours on Sunday, which is noon to 6.
Okay.
And then we're closed Monday and Tuesday, because also during the week we have pretty heavy production going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to kind of focus on production during the week as much as possible. But we're open during the week, and TJ, our tasting room manager, is always out there, ready to go. So.
Yeah, he was really nice. Yeah, guys, come out. This was an awesome conversation. Yeah. All right, let's wrap up with a few speed round questions.
Sure.
My favorite one to ask. On your days off, or if you've had a hard day,
mm-hmm,
and you get home, do you have kind of an embarrassing junk food vice that you might head to?
You know, we're such weird foodies. My wife and I are very much foodies, but we have massive respect for engineered food also.
And engineered food.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's a certain amount of thought and effort that goes in by those food chemists to make a lot of these things. And this, I can't say this is what, I don't do this frequently or anything like that, but I do have a weakness for processed cheese food. So, and this is embarrassing because
the can or the slice?
So here's a little bit of a segue into it. So we lived in Paris, France for 4 years.
Oh,
and before I moved there, my brother gave me like the cheese encyclopedia. And I basically, like, France has something like 380 cheese. And I worked through most of those during the 4 years that we were there. And I became a very serious cheese person. And I've given talks at our wineries on cheese. But on one of our trips back to the United States, Zoo, my wife and I, we picked up a bunch of those aerosol cheeses, you know, like the easy cheese, and we brought it to the parties, like in France, and they're like all the French were scoffing, oh, that stuff is horrible and stuff like that. But then by the end of the night, they're upending those aerosol cheeses in their mouths and everything, and so
it's like backing all of cheese.
It's totally disgusting, but it's engineered to taste good. It hits some little thing.
Oh, it's delicious. I'm sorry. I used to have to give my dog pills with the easy cheese.
Yeah.
And you always kind of get some for yourself, too, mm-hmm, while you're there.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep.
Oh, that's amazing. I love that one. And you engineered food. I just finished a book called The Dorito Effect.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about the science of Doritos and the way that scientists enhance flavors and catch you that way.
And that's really what I mean. Like, I mean, I don't do those things regularly, but you have to say that, like, they know what they're doing. Like, I mean, there's been a lot of time and effort put into those things.
No kidding.
And I would much rather have a tomato grown on a plant in my backyard But there's something to be respected there.
Right, exactly. I totally agree with you. I so agree. What, do you have a Bodo's order when you go to Bodo's?
You know, this is going to sound so bad, but
oh, no.
I used to be a bagel baker. So I'm pretty snobby about when my bagels.
Yeah.
So I think Bodo's is quite good, but it's not as good as the New York style boiled bagel that I would start making at 3 a.m. in the morning at the place I worked at and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So
totally.
I tend not to do Bodo's, and I tend to go to Ace Biscuit and Barbecue next door as my breakfast. So
it's like right here.
Yeah,
and it's amazing.
And I can smell it here in my office, and it draws me down there. And the old dirty biscuit for me is tough to resist. So
you smell it, and you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'll get another one.
Yeah.
God, you lived in Paris. Is there a food city that you would fly to eat if I gave you a free ticket right now?
Paris is pretty darn good. But as much as I love Paris, I spent time in Thailand also, and I did cooking classes up in Chiang Mai. And it's tough to beat Thailand. Like, I mean, the freshness of the fruit and vegetables, and I'm really into spice. So I'd probably say Chiang Mai or Bangkok would be my place. And even like some of the cooking classes I took, the instructor would have us jump over people's backyard walls and we'd go and like grab mangosteen or ginger roots from people's backyards and stuff like that. So it's just like the level of freshness is just amazing over there. And they really like have pride in their food too. Mm-hmm. So that like they put effort in to make it really good stuff over there too.
Wow. And that's so on my list of places to go. That's a good one.
Yeah. I spent a good 3 months there.
Whoa.
Going all through Southeast Asia and stuff. So.
Oh, wow. I'm jealous. Nice.
Yeah. I've tried to always had my, like, I have these, I change job. I used to change jobs quite frequently, being a scientist. And I would always try, once I set up my next job, I'd usually take 3 months off and do something big. One of them was Southeast Asia, 3 months. One of them was working at the wineries, the harvest season I worked. I also spent something like 2-ish months in the Greek islands. Having a job set up and knowing you're going to go back and start making money gives you that freedom to basically blow all your money on a vacation, then land and start making money again or something like that. So I try to take advantage of that.
I just read an article about digital nomads, like folks that don't have a home. They travel all over the world and they're just in web development.
Yeah. And this was a long time. I did the Thailand thing in like 2002. But there were a lot of people even that long ago just with their laptops and they could, you know, it's once you're over in Thailand, it's cheap to live there. Mm-hmm. And they could make enough money to basically sustain themselves with jobs in America, but just doing things out of their laptops and everything like that. So,
oh man,
it's very doable.
Oh, that's, I was 20 years younger, maybe. Oh my God. Oh, dreaming. This is always the last question I end with. And I've kind of enjoyed this so much. I've learned a lot today. Thank you. Who in the Charlottesville region, food-wise, should I interview next?
You know, a great person that I would really test out, if you haven't met him yet, is Mark Jones. Do you know him? He runs Sherrindale Mushroom Farm. And he's a expert mycologist. He's really knowledgeable.
I know the name, but I haven't been
out
there.
Yeah, so it's up in Keswick, basically. Okay. So it's not far away. And we met him. Both my wife and I are amateur wild mushroom hunters. And my wife did kind of like a little foray kind of in the woods for Monticello for the Harvest Festival. And then he was actually teaching a class on like mushroom culture, like actually growing them and everything like that. So we got to meet him there and he invited us out to the farm. We got to check out his whole setup and everything like that. And
That's so cool.
I think he's a really good person to get on your
schedule. And that's coming up here soon, Heritage Harvest, in a couple
weeks. That's right. Yeah, it's a couple weeks.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been amazing. Guys, September is Virginia Spirits Month. Mm-hmm. Enjoy them in moderation or not. and thank you again so much.
Absolutely.
All right. I'm not going to lie. I got so thirsty after this conversation. Oh, I wanted to go downstairs and have a cocktail so bad. And I could do it because the tasting room, we recorded in Ian's office and the tasting room is right downstairs. And it took every ounce of my being to say no when he offered me a cocktail because I had 3 other appointments to make. And I got to stay fairly clear. And I'm old, so I'm kind of a cheap date these days. But I tell you what, I bought some of that platinum rum. And the minute this episode goes up, I'm making myself a daiquiri. I've got the lime. I've got the syrup made. I made some last night. So it's at the ready. It's downstairs. And I could not sneak a little taste of the platinum rum. And guys, it's lovely. I'm kind of an aged rum fan. I love the Ron Zapata in a snifter after dinner. It's so warm and lovely. But this platinum rum, man, it's damn good. It's really good. I cannot wait to taste this daiquiri. I have a feeling it's going to be one of the best I've ever had. As I said, the best one I ever had was in Key West, oddly enough, right? I mean, come on. All right, I'm rambling way too much. Let me get off of here. We talk about community at the beginning, and that's how I want to end this podcast as well, with community. I created this podcast for community. It's my first goal and value on the website. It's why I do this. And yes, Charlottesville is changing. Our community is changing. Rose Hill is changing. Change is the only constant in this life. How we address it and how we accept it is up to us. I wake every morning and I set my intention. Help me to accept whatever happens today. And you know, real community change takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. I remember Obama saying this many, many times. People like a quick fix, but real lasting change takes time, and it takes many, many smaller incremental ones that add up to something lasting. I'm going to leave you with that thought. I hope you are well. I hope this podcast finds you and yours happy and well. Next up, I've got Sarah Aducci of Feast, Jake Bushing of Jake Bushing Wines, Travis Croxton of Rappahannock Oyster, and so many others. Please join me next time. Thank you for being my guest. Thank you to Teej.fm and my sponsors over at patreon.com/audaciouspod. As always, you can find me at iTunes. The website is audacious.co. I welcome your comments. And until next time, I am Janae Libby of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. I'm ferocious, loquacious, very gracious. And when it comes to learning about food and keeping those community connections going, I'm audacious. Blah. Let me try that again. When it comes to learning about food and keeping those connections going, I'm audacious, and I hope you are too, guys. Live in a state of audacity. And always have a big love, big love, big love.